From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week, we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C., where everybody has become an apt judge on debate behavior.
The government has required some religious organizations to violate their tenets.
For some time now, we've viewed with growing alarm the ongoing erosion of religious liberty in our land.
We've talked repeatedly on this show about the misapplication of the terms religious freedom and religious liberty to describe an ever-growing list of perceived threats as defined by conservative Christian leaders, usually expressed most loudly when the issue at hand has some political component to it. From marriage equality to contraception to a woman's right to choose, we see the pursuit of freedom for all being increasingly challenged by demands for freedom of the few. So, how is religious freedom really doing? Beyond this narrow rhetoric, what's the situation across the globe for religious groups that are truly oppressed and sometimes even at risk for their very lives? A new study from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life attempts to measure that, and the report's title suggests the news is not so good. We'll hear from the author of the report titled Rising Tide of Restrictions on Religion, Dr. Brian Grimm. He'll be with us later on this week's show.
Our biggest problem, though, isn't our differences. Our biggest problem is that we build identity, whatever our religion, we build identity by enforcing hostility toward the other. In other words, I learn who I am by learning who I'm against.
Why did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad cross the road? It's not a joke, but find out about it when we talk to the author of this new book with that very title, Brian McLaren. But first,
well, it was clear from the start of last night's debate that Mitt Romney really saw this as an opportunity to shake up the race. He came out aggressive, he came out well-prepared, and he put the president on defense for much of the 90 minutes.
The next stage in the 2012 race for the White House started this past Wednesday evening with the first presidential debate of the season. Both campaigns have been affected by political rhetoric, as often through having to react to issues raised by supporters and opponents alike as through anything else. And there was a lot of speculation ahead of the debate about if and how the subject would come up. Well, one of the most cogent analyses appeared in the Washington Post on religion section earlier this week, written by Georgetown University Assistant Professor Jacques Berlinerblau. He's also the author of the new book, How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. And I am very happy to have Dr. Berlinerblau joining us now on State of Belief Radio. He's been on this show before. Today, he's here to review what we heard this past Wednesday evening. Dr. Berlinerblau, welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Take just a minute, if you will, to summarize your article in the Washington Post.
Sure. I mean, the general frame for the article was that the debates in general are not a good place to do your faith and values politicking. It's very hard to get into questions of faith when you're face-to-face with your adversary in front of, oh, I don't know, a quarter or maybe half of the American people. So my prediction was you wouldn't hear much. But if you did hear something about religion, you'd hear something along the lines of what happened last Wednesday night in Denver.
Did you get the feeling that there was a deliberate attempt on the part of either candidate to not get caught up in religious language in that debate?
Yeah, I think they tend to be very uncomfortable, especially when they're face-to-face talking about these sorts of things. But Romney did craft out a little paragraph for himself towards the end where he went strong with a lot of the themes that I thought he was going to stress, in particular this idea of religious freedom and religious liberty, which has become a thorn in the side of the Obama campaign.
Were you surprised that Obama didn't respond to the opponent's comment?
I was surprised about everything vis-a-vis Obama yesterday. I don't know why he was looking down just in terms of body motion. Yeah. He's done this before. I was thinking about it. He often surprises his base. Uh-huh. And flusters them. I remember once writing an opinion piece for the Chronicle-Ed, and it was entitled, Obama, Do Something, and Do Something was in quotes. And at a few moments in the history of Obama's presence on the American presidential stage, his base has been screaming, Do Something. One example was right when Palin and McCain, prior to the meltdown on Black Monday in September of 2008, they were just racing up in the polls after the convention. So it was Obama, do something. During the deficit crisis, Obama, do something. Mm-hmm. And I think at the debate yesterday, from what I can tell from Democratic friends, they were all Twittering, Obama, do something.
Is he going to do something?
What's amazing about Obama is how he does do something, and he somehow escapes from what seems to be a disastrous situation. So my guess is, in terms of general debating strategies, he's going to come back a lot sharper and a lot tougher at the next debate. If he doesn't, he's in very, very big trouble.
I'm interested in your observation, too, that this whole discussion of religious freedom is a thorn in his side that he probably would just as soon avoid. I don't know that I expected Jim Lehrer to bring that subject up,
right.
but I do have the feeling that to talk about domestic issues right now and not address the controversies that are swirling in the religious liberty area is somewhat a mistake.
Yeah. I don't know. I think the Obama team's strategy is to really tamp down on anything having to do with religious freedom and religious liberty out of a total fear that this could rouse the nation's largest single denominational voting group, which are Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
So his numbers with Catholics are pretty good. He's still at 54% prior to Wednesday night's debate. So I think this is a very calculated sort of rope-a-dope strategy in which he doesn't want to bring up anything having to do with the HHS mandates. Brouhaha. You're right that at some point he might have to, but I'm not sure we've reached that point just yet.
Yeah. Well, did you see Romney as being frustrated at not being able to say more about that subject?
No, I think towards the end, I think it was a pretty even debate for the first 30 minutes or so.
Uh-huh.
And then Romney just galloped ahead. He did a lot of what in soccer are called set pieces yesterday. There were clearly moments when he would go into a 35 to 75 second run, which was purely scripted. I mean, word for word. And he had this stuff down, and that's fair debating strategy. And it served him very, very well. So he did give a little speech yesterday where he used a lot of code words vis-a-vis religion, which I think were very, very effective. And Obama just said nothing about it. He just let it go.
Well, you know, we used to hear a lot about George W. Bush's coded language. What were the coded words that you picked up on in the debate?
All right. Well, I think the major thing was when he spoke about religious toleration.
Mm-hmm.
The exact quote is, I believe we must maintain our commitment to religious tolerance and freedom mm-hmm. in this country. So that was a clear wink out to the base, right?
Mm-hmm.
Vis-a-vis the HHS difficulties that the Obama administration has endured. That statement also says that we are endowed by our Creator with the right to pursue happiness as we choose. I was Twittering madly at that moment. Whenever Declaration of Independence and constitutional references like that come
mm-hmm.
up, you know a Republican is going to start doing God talk, right?
Mm-hmm.
And saying things like, we get our rights from God,
right.
Not government, in complete contradiction to what we read in Romans 13, 1 and 2, and, you know, render unto Caesar, which is very, very curious that that's become such an it verse this year. Now, we're a nation that believes that we're all children of the same God, and we care for those that have difficulties. That was somewhat new.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where exactly he was going with children of the same God, but rhetorically, it was very, very effective because it put God on the side of Governor Romney, right? So here,
right.
for the first time in the debate, God is mentioned, and it's Romney who's speaking about it, and he's speaking to, I don't know, 80, 90% of the American electorate when he says, we are all children of this God.
But see, I would think that is not a strong appeal to the evangelical base,
right.
because they wouldn't believe that.
Right. But if there were a storyline yesterday, it was Romney pivots to the center, parentheses, finally, right? That was a very, very different Mitt Romney we saw yesterday.
Oh, yeah.
And he was moving to the center. He was probably, assuming that the base is in his back pocket, which it probably is, and assuming that his strategists have now concluded this is no longer a base election, this is a center election, looking at the battleground states. The marching orders yesterday were clear. He was going to present kind of the pre-evangelical Mormon Mitt Romney, almost of 2007 or 2005, a Romney that really was concerned, right, with issues that were not partisanly the issues of the more extreme iteration of the Republican Party that we see now.
Given what you've said about the history of the president, what is your expectation about his involvement in the next debate?
Well, he's going to come out a lot feistier. If he doesn't mention the 47%, he might have an internal mutiny on his hands. He's going to go back to the themes of economic inequality. He will be ready on religion. He won't let Romney own the God talk for the evening. Now, if I'm not mistaken, the next debate is the foreign policy one. So where might we see religion in a foreign policy debate? My guess is there are a lot of legitimate concerns about the freedoms of Christians, particularly in countries that are predominantly Islamic. So that issue might come up vis-a-vis Obama's foreign policy, and he would be well advised to be very, very well prepared to counter what Romney's going to throw at him.
The new book is How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. Tell us about it briefly.
In brief, How to Be Secular is an attempt to resurrect a secular movement, which was actually quite formidable at mid-century. Mm-hmm. And to boil it down into very, very simple terms, the secular movement will work when two of its parts come together. And one part are the great American cohort of non-believers. But the larger part, and the part that played a much larger role in the growth of secularism in the United States, are believers in the United States that would rather not see excessive entanglement between government and religion. And I refer to Baptists, I refer to Jews, I refer to liberal Catholics, all religious minorities that you could name. It's only when all those pieces come together again that we will see some type of pushback to the rather aggressive trespass that we see from some quarters of our society, in which issues of one particular religious group are coming to overrun the way we think about domestic and foreign policy.
I'm going to suggest that we have a longer talk about this because it's a very, very important subject, given the fact that the secular presence is more and more evident in all of the polling on religious data and perspectives on religious freedom.
Right. The possibilities are there.
Dr. Belinda Blau, really do thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio, and I look forward to us talking again really soon about your new book.
Okay. Thank you, Reverend Getty.
We've got to take a short break, but still ahead on this week's show, a new study from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life that suggests things are going in the wrong direction for religious freedom when viewed globally. And up next, a compelling new book, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? The author, Brian McLaren, will be here to answer the question. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Getty. We live in a world where it often seems impossible to get away from news of religion-based conflict and even violence. Reducing such conflict can feel even more difficult. And those of us working for interreligious understanding and cooperation are too often labeled as naive and uninformed. That's one reason that a new book calling for interreligious action is nothing less than a mandate for Christians caught my eye. The book is titled, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World, and its author, Brian McLaren, is on the phone. Brian, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be with you again, Wilson.
Well, let's start with the book's title. as opposed to the old joke about the chicken, that you actually envision these four, Muhammad, the Buddha, Moses, and Jesus, crossing the road of division to get to each other? Is that it?
I think that's a great way to envision it. Yes. One of the most beloved parables that Jesus told was the story of the Good Samaritan. In the story of the Good Samaritan, everybody crosses the road. Either they cross the road to get away from someone who's different than they are, or they cross the road to get towards someone who's different. This, to me, is one of the great challenges for all of us who share any kind of religious identity, but I'm especially thinking of myself as a Christian and my fellow Christian.
Am I correct in assuming that you delegate this actual crossing of the road to the followers of these great people without waiting for their leaders to do so?
Well, of course, since the founders of our different religions either live far distant from one another in space or time, you know, we never can actually see what would happen if they got together and took a walk down the road or sat down for a cup of tea or whatever. But I think we can imagine it, you know, because if those of us who study these great leaders' lives, we know how they treated people. And so I think from their example, we can drive some inspiration that makes it very different to follow our leaders rather than following our fellow followers.
Yeah, that's a great point. Well, your book couldn't be more timely. The most recent turmoil that we've seen in the Middle East just screams about the need for this kind of book. I noticed the release date was September 11, 2012, and I'm wondering, when you saw the headlines on September 11, 2012, what went through your mind?
Well, it was heartbreaking to see this story of a film that is nothing short of base and disgusting, that was obviously intended as provocation and insult to the Muslim people by depicting Muhammad in such a despicable way. And then to see violence erupting in response, boy, at some point you start to realize something that was one of my great discoveries in actually writing this book, and that is that it's not really our religious differences that are causing trouble. It's a religious similarity. It's a characteristic that many sectors of all of our religions have in common, and that is the tendency to build the identity of us in opposition to or hostility toward the identity of them. Mm. And it's strange, isn't it, that when religions become vicious, they resemble one another all the more. The specifics of their doctrinal distinctives or their other cultic or ritual distinctives seem rather insignificant in comparison with the dedication to violence and fear and prejudice and so on.
Oh, that's a great insight. We've got to take another short break, but there's more coming up with my guest, Brian McLaren. You don't want to miss it. He's the author of the thought-provoking new book, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World. And just a reminder that there will be more of this conversation, as well as of all the interviews on this week's show, available online at stateofbelief.com. If you want to hear more, go to stateofbelief.com. You can hear the entirety of the interviews. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. We'll be right back. This free State of Belief radio podcast is brought to you by Interfaith Alliance, representing 185,000 members across the U.S., drawn from 75 different faith traditions. We're committed to protecting faith and freedom. Find out about the work we do to protect the boundaries between religion and government and unite diverse voices to challenge extremism and build common ground by visiting our website, interfaithalliance.org. Whether you care deeply about minority religious rights, school bullying, LGBT discrimination, the influence of religion on politics, or the influence of politics on religion, Interfaith Alliance is working on initiatives you'll want to support. Learn more and become a member at interfaithalliance.org. Welcome back to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Can't wait to get back into this conversation. My guest is Dr. Brian McLaren. We're talking about his new book titled, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World. Your book builds on a very simple premise. Essentially, what would Jesus do with respect to the fathers of the other great religions? I'd like for you to expand on that very simple principle.
Sure. Well, as someone who is a deeply committed Christian and who not only studies Christ and believes in him, but I really love him, you know, one of the things I know in my study of Jesus in the four Gospels is this. He was a keen judge of human character. Now, when I say judge, I don't mean judge like someone who likes to assess and find fault and condemn. He's almost the opposite kind of judge. He's the kind of person who sees in someone whatever little seed of faith is there, whatever spark of the image of God is there, Jesus sees it and fans the flame. So you have just stories from the Gospels. Peter's a great example. I mean, a lot of people would have looked at Peter and saw a kind of a pious, blowhard fisherman, and Jesus saw beneath that and saw the potential of real leadership. Or you think of Jesus encountering a Samaritan woman who everyone else just saw first. They saw her through the eyes of racial and religious prejudice, but also the people who knew her knew that she had a pretty sordid sexual past. Yet, Jesus saw her as a person of value, willing to engage with her. In story after story in the Gospels, people are brought before Jesus who everyone else condemns or rejects, and Jesus stands with them and affirms something in them. Knowing that about Jesus, I just can't help but think that if the Buddha or Muhammad or obviously Jesus' own forefather Moses, if they'd been brought before him, they would have felt in his presence that they were seen with the most compassionate and loving eyes that they'd ever been seen with. You know, and I think if you know anything about the Buddha or Muhammad or Moses, you'd have reason to say that they would also encounter one another with respect and interest rather than the kind of knee-jerk reaction that is so common among religious people today.
I wonder if you have encountered something that I've been noticing more and more lately, that when you are speaking from the Gospels and you're pointing to Jesus as a good example for how to do interreligious work and peace work specifically, I've got a lot of people now saying to me, oh, Jesus never really did intend that we obey him. His ethic is really not for today. He never expected us in our kind of world to live like that. You hear that?
Oh, I do. In fact, there's a certain sector of conservative Christian thought called dispensationalism that says that the teaching of Jesus is actually not intended for today. And then there are others who dispense with the teachings of Jesus by saying their only purpose is to help us see what terrible sinners we are so that we'll need another set of doctrines to bring us relief from our guilt. If that's the case, then Jesus made a pretty big mistake by using that command, follow me, because follow me means imitate me, learn from me, follow my example.
Right.
And if that's the case, the Holy Spirit made a big mistake in inspiring Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because all he really needed to give us was the book of Romans. And even that book, I think, is grossly misinterpreted when people read it that way.
So, absolutely.
But it is common. And I think this is why I imagine people like you and me and many others are willing to stick our necks out, because we realize that the Christian faith really is at a crossroads in history in many ways, in our part of the world at any rate, because the Christian faith has to decide whether it really wants to be a faith that develops Christ-like people and that encourages Christ-like love, and that really does see Jesus as the one we're to follow and whose image is one that we want to be transformed into.
In your new book, Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road, Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World, you challenge what's probably the number one and misguided, if you ask me, criticism of interfaith activism, and that is that in the search for common ground, one ends up with a diluted broth of the most innocuous of tenets and beliefs. You write that a strong Christian identity actually fosters, even demands, effective interreligious engagement. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is. And it's very understandable why some people would feel that the only way to reduce religious hostility is to water the whole thing down. You know, if, mm-hmm. if you made a soup or a stew and you put in way too much red pepper, you can't cool the thing down unless you water it down.
Yeah.
But the watering down of faith produces all kinds of unhelpful consequences of its own, one of which, an obvious one, is if you water down your faith so that it doesn't really mean that much anymore, it's just a kind of vague moral niceness, which I think is what a lot of people perceive certain elements of the faith to be, then your kids grow up and they think, why have any kind of commitment to that faith at all? It's just not that big a deal. Mm-hmm. Well, if that happens, then within a few generations, the only people left holding faith are the people holding a strong and hostile faith. And so I think this is why we have to rediscover a new vision of our faith. I call it a reformulation mm-hmm. of our faith that doesn't just throw out our doctrines, but rather acknowledges the way some of our doctrines have been used for great harm and rediscovers them as healing teachings, as teachings that actually have the power to heal the very wounds that have been inflicted in the name of God and the name of religion. And that, to me, is a more vibrant faith. One way to say it is, if I see a neighbor who is a person of another race, another faith, another political party, another socioeconomic background, if I'm just operating on the old law of familiarity, that mm-hmm. birds of a feather flock together, I'll stay away from that person. Mm-hmm. But if I have really become a follower of Jesus, then I will cross the road toward that person. I'll be drawn toward that person. And that, to me, becomes an expression of my faith, not a watering down of it in any
yeah.
way.
Dr. Brian McLaren is the author of over a dozen books. His latest, just out from Jericho Books, is titled Why Did Jesus, Moses, the Buddha, and Muhammad Cross the Road? Christian Identity in a Multi-Faith World. Dr. McLaren, thank you for what you're doing, and thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's time for another quick break, and then we're going to hear from Brian Grimm, author of the new study from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, titled Rising Tide of Restrictions on Religion. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Welcome back, everyone, to State of Belief Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. Recently, the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life released its latest report on the state of religious freedom around the world. The report is called Rising Tide of Restrictions on Religion. Brian Grimm is the author of this sweeping new report. He's the senior researcher and director of cross-national data at Pew, and he joins us right now. Dr. Grimm, welcome.
I'm glad to be with you.
Why is the latest report titled Rising Tide of Restrictions on Religion?
Yes, well, our report found that restrictions are rising in every region of the world, including some regions that previously had shown a slight decrease in restrictions on religion or social hostilities involving religion, such as the Americas and sub-Saharan Africa. What we find now is that a substantial portion of the world's population, about 75% or 3 out of every 4 people, live in a country where there are either high government restrictions on religion or high social hostilities involving religion, and that's up from 70% just a year ago.
And additionally, we've seen the increases occur in countries that not only began the period with high or very high restrictions or hostilities, but also in countries that began the period with low or moderate restrictions, such as the United Kingdom, Switzerland, and the United States.
Would you talk a little more about your findings in unexpected places like Switzerland and the United States?
Yeah, so in Switzerland, there was a nationwide campaign to ban the building of any minarets on mosques. Currently, there are only 4 mosques that have minarets in Switzerland, but there was a reaction against having minarets on mosques representing the growth of Islam in Switzerland. So there's a national referendum that was passed, and now it's part of the constitutional law of the country that no mosque can put a minaret on their mosque. Also, in other countries such as the United States that began the period with low government restrictions, we saw an uptick in government restrictions. But this is primarily due to incidents at the local or state level. For instance, we saw problems faced by religious groups seeking to build or enlarge their buildings through zoning restrictions, limitations on religious dress or grooming in certain judicial settings or in prisons. And during this period, we also saw several legislative attempts to restrict the application of Islamic or Sharia law, which in itself is not permitted as a code in U.S. law, but this was more of an anti-Muslim attempt in using legislative means to target one particular religion. On the other side, in the United States, we also saw an increase in social hostilities involving religion, and these included several factors. We had 3 terrorist events that involved religion, the Fort Hood shootings, the underwear bomber, and the Times Square's bomber. The increases also included other incidents, such as community attempts to ban the construction of a mosque in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and also an uptick in a very different kind of discrimination. We noted more religious discrimination in public workplace hiring.
You break the data into 2 categories, government restrictions and society's restrictions. Is one of those worse than the other based on your research?
Globally, we've seen an increase in both, but what we saw was primarily an increase in the number of lower-level incidents that sort of raised the problems throughout the world. So it wasn't as if another 9/11 incident happened during this time period, but it was more the accumulation of either governments trying to restrict religion or people in society having more hostilities, often towards minority religious groups, during this period. And one thing to keep in mind is that our study only goes through mid-2010, and that's the period right before the uprisings that are known as Arab Spring occurred. And one interesting finding of our study is that that government restrictions in particular were tightening in many of the countries that experienced Arab Spring revolutions, particularly in Egypt. Egypt had an ongoing pattern of increasing government restrictions before that period, and it was the country where the uprisings spread to right after they started in Tunisia, which also had high and rising restrictions during the period before Arab Spring.
Are there families of religions that are seeing more restrictions than others?
What we find is that harassment based on religious bias or discrimination occurs to all religious groups, that they face some problem in one country or another. What we do find is that Christians face the harassment from governments or from members of society in the largest number of countries. But that's not too surprising, given that Christianity is the largest single family of religions, as you call it. Then in the religious group that faces harassment in the second largest number of countries are Muslims. And again, they're the second largest religious group, so that's not particularly surprising. But then what we find are smaller religious groups such as Jews, which make up less than 1% of the global population, face harassment or discrimination in more than a third of countries. So many of these restrictions will target or hostilities target religious minorities. And I should say that it's often the Christians. Christians are often harassed when they're a minority. The one exception is that Muslims tend to be harassed in Muslim-majority countries in higher proportion than they are outside of Muslim-majority countries, which is surprising to many people. But if you consider the sectarian divisions in all, such as in Iraq, or authoritarian governments such as in Egypt, which had somewhat of an anti-religious bias, then that helps explain why Muslims face problems even within Muslim-majority countries.
Religious freedom has been central to so much of the rhetoric, political rhetoric, in the United States during this election cycle. Does that in any way dilute the power of the very concept when you analyze extreme environments of true restrictions on religion worldwide?
Well, what, I mean, that's a very good question. And one of the things that we've done in our study is to specifically measure the flip side of religious freedom, which is restrictions on religion coming either from governments or societies. Because religious freedom is, it's very difficult to measure and precisely define what a freedom is. But we found that by focusing on restrictions and hostilities, it puts it into a more, let's say, social science way of looking at this issue. And we've had very good response from a number of countries and governments around the world to looking at it this way. So rather than blaming a country or calling out a country for having low or religious freedom, instead we can look at trends and restrictions and hostilities, because indeed many countries believe that restrictions are necessary and beneficial to maintain peace and security in the country. So by engaging and using this kind of vocabulary, we've been able to extend the discussion beyond just the United States, but involve other countries as well.
Was there anything in the report that you personally found particularly surprising?
Well, one thing that I found surprising is that of the 20 different types of government restrictions that we monitor each year, including bans on conversion, limits on religious broadcasting, limits on preaching, government use of force against religious groups, government biased favoritism of one religious group above others. Of all these different restrictions we monitor, on average, when these restrictions are in place, social hostilities tend to be higher in those countries than lower. And it's quite a striking finding, and you can see it on our website, a chart showing these data, that often governments perceive that the best way to control social hostilities involving religion is by adding additional restrictions. But the data itself shows something of a different picture, that when government restrictions are in place, that doesn't coincide with lower hostilities. Still, we're not answering the chicken and egg question, whether the restrictions cause the hostilities, but this certainly is a new finding. So I think many people will find that a very interesting and thought-provoking finding.
Dr. Brian Grimm is the senior researcher and director of cross-national data at the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, and the author of the new report titled Rising Tide of Restrictions on Religion. The entire report is available online at pewcenter.org. Dr. Grimm, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Glad to be with you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com, and you can find out more about the show. You can hear the extended interviews of today that you've only heard a part of. You can read transcripts, and you can sign up for our podcasts. You can learn about the new State of Belief app for iPhone and Android devices. And if you have those, you already know this, you can listen to us anywhere, anytime. Share your thoughts, please, on what you've heard. Share them on Facebook and Twitter. Contact information is available if you need it at stateofbelief.com, including the toll-free listener line 800-856-0277. We encourage you to tell others about the show. We would love for them to be listeners as well, and we'd love for you all to get together and have conversations about what we talk about on this show, and then let us know about it. Let us know your feelings. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Interfaith Alliance needs your involvement and support and activism. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And of course, join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. You don't ever know what you're going to see in that intersection. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That State of Belief.